This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Welcome to Lingua Franca on ABC Radio National. I'm Jill Kitson. This week, Language, the Great Conduit. David Wiggins, who is a philosopher and a linguistic conservative, explains how he takes his stand against anything goes. The BBC's Reith Lecturer in 1996 was the sociolinguist Jean Aitchison, who is Rupert Murdoch Professor of Language and Communication at Oxford University. Taking The Language Web as her title, Professor Aitchison began by dismissing what she called the cobweb of false worries that surrounds language. English, she said, is not changing for the worse. People who dispute this are like cranks who argue that the world is flat. After showing that the central task of modern linguistics is descriptivist, Professor Aitchison went on to argue, by extension, for permissivism in language matters. David Wiggins, the then Wickham Professor of Logic in the University of Oxford, challenged both the Reith Lecturer's logic and her premises. He took his inspiration from the great 16th century philosopher John Locke's extended metaphor of language as the great conduit. Here's David Wiggins.
In a passage of the essay concerning human understanding, which Jean Aitchison quoted at the beginning of her second Reith lecture, John Locke wrote this: "Language being the great conduit whereby men convey their discoveries, reasonings, and knowledge from one to another, he that makes an ill use of it does as much as in him lies break or stop the pipes whereby it is distributed to the public use and advantage of mankind." I shall come back to this wonderful sentence. Taking Locke's image of a conduit as his definition of language, rather than as one truth about it, Professor Aitchison found the image misleading. She complained that it leaves no room for the non-cognitive uses of language, typical of behaviour that is biologically programmed. The phrasing of this criticism of Locke is significant. The modern linguist sees herself not as a humanist or as a participating member of the Republic of Letters. She sees herself as a scientist for whom language is one, albeit singular, aspect of human biology and psychology. Her role is to describe and explain the language function in the manner of an empirical scientist. Conservative critics of the Reith lectures paid little attention to Professor Aitchison's account of the state of language science. Instead, they accused her of preaching that in language matters, anything goes. She was encouraging ordinary people to forego their precious birthright in standard English, the very language in which she herself gave the lectures. Aitchison dismissed the conservative responses, accusing her critics of upholding the snobbish prescriptions of an obsolete linguistic etiquette and repeating hackneyed complaints. She accused them of pointless nostalgia for some imaginary epoch of timeless perfection. Now, it's true that linguistic conservatives have sometimes looked back to an ideal state of language, as when Samuel Johnson said that he looked back at pre-Restoration writings as wells of English undefiled. But let it be noted that Johnson is the same witness whom Aitchison herself called upon to attest with her that to enchain syllables and lash the wind are equally the undertakings of pride. How can Johnson have said both of these things? Linguistic conservatism, as I defend it, begins by declaring that the way in which people think is all of a piece with the way in which they talk. It's a measure of the thoughtfulness or thoughtlessness of an era, how many people know how to make the word or phrase or sentence they utter be their choice to say this rather than that. To announce such a position is already to take speaking or writing for an art, one which promotes a highly non-natural purpose. I expect that the linguist will butt in to say that they cannot extend their scientific approval to any particular purpose to which language may be harnessed, or second the value judgments that conservatives derive from such purposes. The simple fact is that conservative complaints are not evidence-based. To this, the conservative must reply that even if it's not for linguists to approve of the idea that writing or speaking is an art, it's not for linguists to disapprove either. It's just a fact, moreover, that some people have this non-natural purpose. Linguistic conservatives do not ground either their outlook or their purpose in the psychoneural nature of language, but nor do they ground it in the idea that for ever and ever we should draw our speech from the wells of an English forever unchanged. They ground it in their aspirations for language not as timeless, but as a vehicle of thought, and an instrument for its telling, articulate, and graceful expression. The conservatives' next claim must be this: if language is to subserve the non-natural purposes of talking and writing, each being considered as an art, then language needs, among other things, power and precision. But power and precision depend everywhere upon the husbanding of differences. Everywhere, their enemy is entropy. How, then, does language counter entropy? It husbands differences by setting norms. That is where prescriptions will come in. Norms are not regularities that lie open to the unblinking stare of the sociolinguist. They're practical claims upon a speaker, deriving from facts about what exactly this or that expression is used to say in the language to which the speaker holds answerable all his or her speaking or writing. That language is changeable, no doubt. It's a social object and a constant renewal. The thing that is special about any particular language is not that it's timelessly ideal, but that as it stands at the point of speaking or writing, this language is, for the asking, his or her language, the indefinitely divisible birthright, by possessing which one can draw at will upon a huge residue of that which has, up to now, been thought, discovered, or felt. Language is that by which speakers and their inheritors can reach out beyond their own narrow world. Here let us go back to John Locke and the Great Conduit. The conduit that he speaks of carries something wholesome to the public, and carries it by pipes. Consider then London's New River, not a river but a freshwater channel, that Sir Hugh Middleton, with the subvention of James I, brought all the way from a chalk outcrop in Hertfordshire to an open basin he had lined with stone slabs near Sadler's Wells in Islington, North London. The channel, 10 foot wide and lined at various points with clay, wood, or other materials, was dug along a contour, with a gentle fall of only 18 feet from start to finish along its meandering 40-mile route. At the southernmost end, the basin in Islington distributed fresh water to city subscribers by means of wooden pipes hollowed from elm trunks. In conception and execution, the New River was a triumph, but at every point in its entire length it was liable to leakage, to collapse, and to contamination. On pain of its not conveying that which it was designed to convey, it stood in need of constant repair, both major and minor. Among major repairs, some were effected by engineers of later times who cut out troublesome sections by building aqueducts. They reduced the length of the river to 27 miles. If language is at all like the Great Conduit, then the thing that language needs, or so the Lockean metaphor suggests, is unremitting maintenance, maintenance subsuming improvements. This is to say that the thing language needs at any time is for its norms of sense and syntax to be sustained. How, though, will they be sustained in the absence of prescription? Exhortations and reminders about what means what in English say nothing either way for or against change. In the here and now, they simply sustain prescriptions for the here and now. They do, however, to quote Samuel Johnson again, serve to retard what we cannot repel and palliate what we cannot cure. The effect of observance is to combat entropy, to make room for artistic and intellectual purposes that are pursued in language, and to preserve and perpetuate meanings. If each generation has backed its prescriptions with lamentation and protestation, that is what you would expect. It's the price we pay for holding on to something precious. If what I've said helps to make sense of linguistic conservatism, then how should the dispute be decided between the conception I've tried to explain and the descriptive conception, which sees language as a psychological function? Well, if might is right, then the verdict will go to the descriptivists and their allies in the fields of education, politics, and communications. I think I know these people by their works and by their victims, among whom I number each new generation of students for whom it's more difficult than it was for the last to read, in the original, as one might say, John Locke, Samuel Johnson, Adam Smith, or even J.S. Mill. Even worse, the state of affairs in which almost no one knows what it would take to say exactly what they mean, or nobody can report anybody else saying no more and no less than they actually say, is a gift to political disorder and violence. In a dangerous way, it narrows the political possibilities. Nobody's going to take my word for that, however. So, for this occasion, I shall simplify my plea. Let persons of goodwill distinguish between descriptivism as a program within linguistics and the permissivism that Professor Aitchison has fallaciously deduced from that program. Then let me invite them to discover their own preference between two careful English versions of an ancient Chinese text, a text less familiar and less contentious than the Bible. In this text, the subject, he, is one who conducts himself with the sense of honour and ritual that Confucius approves. The tablet of jade is the symbol of a ruler's feudal investiture. When carrying the tablet of jade, he seems to double up, as though borne down by its weight. He holds it at the highest as though he were making a bow, at the lowest as though he were proffering a gift. His expression, too, changes to one of dread, and his feet seem to recoil, as though he were avoiding something. When presenting ritual presents, his expression is placid. At a private audience, his attitude is gay and animated. Here is the second version. When he held the jade tablet, he gathered himself in as if he would not cope with it. At the highest, he held it as if he were bowing, and at the lowest, as if he were making a presentation. His expression became serious and apprehensive, and his feet were constricted as if his progress were hindered. When he presented ritual gifts, he wore a complacent expression. At private audiences, he seemed at ease. These are translations from the Analects of Confucius. The second, dated 1994, comes with the cachet of a great university press. The first, and earlier one, comes from Arthur Whaley. Anyone who prefers the first must ask what attitude to words and writing or speaking it was that made Whaley's version possible, and then they must ask themselves what attitude they think we must have.
David Wiggins. His new book is Ethics, Lectures on the Philosophy of Morality, A Penguin. This talk was adapted from a Times Literary Supplement commentary.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.